have an opportunity to consider those amendments. I mean, these are, it's frankly a very dramatic change to the levels of proof that are required to succeed with an act like this. As we've heard the testimony, it would dramatically change the landscape of consumer protection actions in Minnesota, and I think that committee ought to hear it. I'm going to offer an amendment to refer it to the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee rather than to the floor. I've also distributed, sort of unrelated to that question, but I've had distributed a representative client's list of the Perryman Group, the author of that study that was cited for the costs related to tort reform, the savings related to tort reform. I think if you look at it on the merits, it at least raises questions in my mind about the any bias that might have been involved in the study and its results. But that's more on the merits, not on where the bill goes from here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Regarding the motion to amend the amend, I think I just amended my own motion to send the bill to the Senate floor, so I'm not sure whether it's in order or not. I'm not trying to bypass the question about whether this should go to the Commerce Committee, but I disagree that it should go to the Commerce Committee. I do think this is appropriate for the Judiciary Committee because we are talking about whether or not there's an interlocutory appeal, and we're talking about what stage is some requirement of proof necessary in one of these cases. I think it fits squarely within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee, frankly.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Sarah Letts.
It's not the interlocutory appeal part that I'm concerned about for the Consumer Protection Committee, but it's Section 2 in particular that deals with the Prevention of Consumer Fraud Act. I would expect that any other bill that were introduced that made changes in the Prevention of Consumer Fraud Act would at some point in the process be considered by the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee, even if it originated here and fell within our jurisdiction.
Okay. Senator Letts, the information on the bottom of page 1, it makes reference to unlawful trade practices and prevention of consumer fraud, but we're not making any changes to that. We're just making reference to it. So I don't believe that this motion should go to, or the motion should include a move to the Commerce Committee. However, we'll have a vote on your motion.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chairman, if I may, it's not an inconsequential reference. It's changing the requirements of proof to succeed in an action under those statutes. That's a substantive change to consumer protection law in Minnesota. And one which, if you believe the testimony from some of the witnesses, would essentially eviscerate those causes of action. It would wipe out the effectiveness of some of those causes of action. So I think it's a very substantial change that committee ought to consider. I would think their members and their chair might agree with that. I don't know if they've had a chance to consider this, but...
Senator Letts, I know for a record that the Commerce Committee has not requested this hearing or this bill to their committee, and I would disagree with your motion. Is there any further discussion about Senator Letts' motion to amend the Ortman motion? I've been given technical advice that since Senator Ortman has already amended her motion once, Senator Latz's motion is not in play at this time because there's an amendment on the motion that's already been accepted. So the motion remains of Senator Ortman to move Senate File 149 to the floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Also on our agenda today is Senate File 373. And if you'll remember at the beginning, I mentioned
Senator Ortman.
Yeah.
We just amended your motion.
And
now we have the full motion before us.
Right. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Letts.
Would my motion be in order at this time?
Yes.
I'll have to check with council.
Yes, it would.
I'm getting a nod yes. Senator Lantz.
I move to amend refer this to Commerce and Consumer Protection.
All right. Any further discussion? Senator Ingebrigts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did the chairman of that particular committee want to see this bill?
Senator Ingebrigts, we have not heard any request from the Commerce Department.
Thank you.
Commerce Committee. Any further discussion?
I would just note, Mr. Chairman, that the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, that is this coalition promoting this bill, identifies themselves as working for jobs and consumers. And in a press conference this morning, they touted these here as consumer-friendly or consumer protection efforts. So certainly within the policy jurisdiction of Commerce and Consumer Protection.
All right. Any further discussion on the Latz motion, amending the Ortman motion? All those in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no.
No.
No. Motion does not prevail.
I'm not going to present the next bill until we vote, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman renews her motion to recommend it to pass Senate File 149 be recommended to the floor. All as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members again.
Thank you.
Once again, we have Senate File 373, which adjusts the default statutes of limitations in the state of Minnesota to bring them more in line and competitive with other states. And we have with us Mr. Dale Thorns Joe, I hope I said that correctly, from
Thank
the
you.
Johnson & Condon law firm, who will testify in support.
Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Good afternoon, Senator, members of the committee. My name is Dale Thorns Joe. I'm an attorney with the practice of Johnson & Condon in Edina. I have practiced civil litigation for more than 25 years, not only in this jurisdiction, but also in several other jurisdictions on a pro hoc vice or a federal bar admission basis. I have handled a variety of contract and tort matters over those years, statutory claims brought involving a lot of litigation that I have handled. A member of the federal and the state bars, both here and in the Federal Bar Association. I'm also a member of the Defense Research Institute and its local arm, the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. I am here today to speak in favor of Senate File 373, which is a measure to reduce limitation period for certain actions as well as the residual statute of limitation, which governs negligence actions. Members of the committee, this bill's effect is in three specific areas. The request is to reduce the length of time in which a lawsuit can be brought from 6 years to 4 years in three general areas. First is a variety of tort types of cases, including negligence under the residual statute of limitation provision, as well as in other tort areas such as trespass, conversion, and fraud. This also addresses the statute of limitations applicable to statutory cases as well, such as consumer fraud, as well as for contract cases. This statute is actually rather unique. It is one of the remaining holdovers of original territorial legislation. It was passed prior to the time the state became a state, and the six-year statute presented in this provision has remained at 6 years, even though the primary mode of transportation is no longer horse, the primary mode of communication is no longer mail. Frankly, it's no longer even telephone. It's no longer even fax. The advent of the Internet and the advent of email has compressed time in such a fashion that worries about unable to find a defendant, unable to find witnesses, which motivated the original length of time for a statute of limitations being 6 years, is really no longer part of what society is these days. There is an ability to find instantaneously individuals. There is an ability to find people, to serve people. and therefore there is no reason to allow the public policy of this state to let claims languish when remedies can be enforced and lawsuits can be concluded within a much more reasonable time than 6 years. Keep in mind as well, the 6 years was passed long before Minnesota recognized a variety of matters that changed how statutes of limitations are affected. There are several areas of law where the discovery of a cause of action is now the accrual and therefore the commencement of the statute of limitation. Back in 1848, 1851, there just simply was not the ability to have an accrual cause of action, a delay discovery cause of action, and it was no doubt another reason why there was such a long period of time involved to allow a litigant to commence their lawsuit. Clearly, if a claim such as a fraud claim, which is part of this statute, and if you look at the statute itself, the fraud aspect of it is the length of time is from discovery of that fraud. And it just seems that the fraud example is almost the shining example of why should someone who has discovered their cause of action be allowed to wait for 6 years, which may result in the passage of time that witnesses may no longer be available, that witnesses' memories may well fade, that documents or electronic information may no longer be available, and then at 5 years, 11 months, and 25 days, a lawsuit then be commenced. The concept of what is considered a stale claim is markedly different today than what it was back in when this was originally passed. The irony with this claim, or with this cause of action, being 6 years, and whether or not we should keep it at 6 years, I tend to take a look at it kind of from a flip side. It's really more from a practical, common sense standpoint. If we chose to not revisit our statutes from time to time in order to be able to reassess what is considered an appropriate statute given the times that we live in, well, then we would keep the same 1848 statute that was enacted as part of this original statute, which required husbands to be sued along with their wives in lawsuits. It is just an underscoring of the fact that from time to time we need to revisit these statutes and consider what is reasonable and appropriate given the times that we live in. We should not allow a plaintiff to have a false sense of security to go out 6 years where they may fail to have the sufficient evidence after that length of time to then bring the lawsuit thinking that their remedy will be available. It may well not be simply because of the passage of time. That reacts the same way for defendants as well. What this does is give a balanced approach to how lawsuits will be addressed in a timely fashion such that they will be addressed on their merits and they will be addressed on their facts. It is not a defense-oriented, nor is it a plaintiff-oriented proposal for a change. What it reflects is a public policy by the state to encourage people to address their disputes immediately, appropriately, and with finality, and not let lawsuits or claims linger. This is very much like what has happened around the country with these types of limitations of actions. There are 42 states, for example, that have negligence causes of actions which are 3 years or less. Minnesota remains only with North Dakota and Maine as a state that has a 6 year statute of limitation. There were six states in 1992 that had a 6 year statute of limitations. Three states since then have also reduced their statutes of limitations, and so we see this continuing evolution of the shortening of the limitation period, just reflecting the realities of modern times and communications. This is also true with areas such as consumer fraud cases, statutory causes of action cases. There are 32 states that have consumer fraud statutes of limitations that are 3 years or less. The drop from 6 years to 4 years as well will frankly bring these causes of action more in line with other statutes of limitations within the state of Minnesota. A perfect example of this is the products liability, strict liability statute, which is a 4-year statute of limitation, as well as the Uniform Commercial Code 4-year statute of limitation. It creates a uniformity of applicable statutes of limitations for a variety of causes of action. It will not create confusion as to which statute can someone sue under, what may be the ability to put evidence in at a particular trial. It will streamline court costs streamline court actions as a result as well. And my last point, members of the committee, is that despite the fact the state has passed changes to the choice of law provisions under 541.31 as to what choice of law will be applied in causes of action with potential foreign plaintiffs who may come to Minnesota, such as what they had done in the federal courts for several years prior to just a few years ago, along with the Flieger Minnesota Supreme Court decision. There still remains a loophole that is potentially available for out-of-state plaintiffs to come to Minnesota if they can show a tenuous connection to the state, or if there has been a determination that, for some reason, that plaintiff may not have had a fair opportunity to sue in their own jurisdiction, and therefore Minnesota, with a 6-year statute of limitation, becomes, in essence, the last court available for someone across the country to be able to come in and try to litigate their claim. And with reduction of this statute of limitation provision down to, frankly, what is an outlier in the negligence area, but more in line with many other jurisdictions across the country and other areas, simply allows the courts to not worry about the potential of future litigation that's going to come in, that may well come in the door. Members of the committee, I urge you to vote in favor of this piece of legislation. This is fair public policy given the times that we are in. It does not favor plaintiffs nor defendants, and it seems to be the most appropriate approach in this day and age. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Thornsjoe, I have a question. In the handout that's describing this bill, under background, the second paragraph, all civil, I'm looking at this page. It would be on the handout that we have. Claims that this proposal, all civil claims are subject to statute of limitations. I understand that basically a legal countdown beginning when someone is injured. This bill is lowering statute of limitations by 2 years. And when would someone know they're injured? Or is it a date of injury to a certain date specific? How does a court determine that?
That's a very good point, Mr. Chairman. When someone is injured is varying from case to case. A typical situation, car crash accident, for example, or a breach of a contract, there is a fairly bright line rule that will happen in the vast majority of cases. There are cases such as latent injury cases or matters where there is not a discovery of the breach of the contract, for example, where there will be a point in time in which they will learn that, in fact, they are injured. The courts have a test that is basically that the accrual of a person's cause of action, which is the time in which an applicable statute of limitation would begin to run, is at the time in which a motion to dismiss the lawsuit would fail. As in other words, if the plaintiff can show in a negligence case duty, breach, causation, and damages, at that point in time, that is when at the first point in time when that happens, that's when the statute of limitations starts to run. There are other types of situations where a discovery rule would not apply. For example, in the medical malpractice area, the courts have decided that they will not apply a discovery rule, and so typically it's the 3 years from date of last treatment issue that governs when the cause of action accrues. We're not dealing with that statute of limitation here today. And so where there are some philosophical or some scholastic differentiations on how you may apply a discovery rule, it generally does not come down into these particular sets of causes of action that are impacted by this bill.
Mr. Thornjoe, could someone be injured and not know the date of injury, but later discover they're injured, and by bringing the statute of limitations down by 2 years, could they fall out of the statute of limitations and therefore not have any standing in court and yet still be injured?
You know, the concept that you talk about is the same question if you would ask if it was 6 years as well. And that is there a point in time in which a plaintiff knew or should have known that their cause of action accrued, and for some reason, and let's presume it's a diligence issue, where they have been diligent, there will be situations where if they are diligent and they have not had their cause of action accrue because they've been diligent, then you don't end up with the commencement of that cause of action or the commencement of that statute of limitation. If they are not diligent, clearly that's a different issue. And what, frankly, a reduction from 6 years to 4 years reflects is a public policy of this state for self-responsibility to make sure that people address their issues, that they don't let their matters, their legal matters, linger. This is true with individuals. This would be true with businesses. This is a very neutral piece of legislation in that regard.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Anyone else to testify regarding Senate File 373? Mr. Carlson? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
I'm Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and I have Jim Carey, the president of our association, here, and I think I'm going to let him start, and then I'll follow up at the end.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Carey.
I'm Jim Carey. I'm president of our association, and the overwhelming question I have, Senator, is why are we doing this? This has worked very well for 150 years, the statute of limitations has a long history, a long legal history. We know that there has been a 40% reduction in lawsuits in the state over the last 10 years. We know that the amount of jury verdicts are down. We know that we're 30th in the country in automobile insurance rates. Medical malpractice is a fantastic system. The Chamber of Commerce has voted us the 11th best place to do business in terms of litigation in the country. And now we're going to change the statute of limitations because somehow someone thinks that that's good for business. There's no proof of that. There's no evidence of that. We simply are encouraged to conclude that if we deprive deserving, innocent people of their right to make a claim, that somehow that will be good for business. I don't believe that that's borne out by the facts. We're talking about a significant change in the law. And if we're going to eliminate individuals' constitutional right to make a claim for an injury, we should have very good reasons to do that. I haven't heard very good reasons. I haven't heard, quite frankly, any reasons that would justify doing that. There has to be a reason other than to say other states have shorter statutes of limitations. In my view, this bill will do nothing, accomplish nothing in terms of creating a better business climate, and it will deprive people of their rights. So I urge you to oppose it. Thank you.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Just to amplify that briefly, we view this as an issue that really doesn't have anything to do with fairness. It has to do with cutting off insurance industry exposure at a quicker pace. And the lawsuit abuse group is just funded an affront for the insurance industry, and that's just what it is. And they are the only ones that benefit from this. Now, this statute of limitations has been the law in Minnesota since statehood, and this is not about jobs. It's just about cutting off insurance industry exposure. And I have a couple of questions about why we are rushing people to the courthouse who are not ready to go. This impacts people who are victims of sexual abuse. They're not ready to go to the courthouse in year 2, 3, or 4. This says, I don't care who abused you. I don't care what happened. 4 years, that's it. You're done. We have to rush them to the courthouse when they're not ready to go to the courthouse. Victims of domestic violence are similarly situated. They may be going through a very difficult divorce. That takes a long time to get through. They have a cause of action for the abuse that they've suffered. Now we're saying 4 years, whether you're ready or not, you better move. Consumer debt is another area where creditors do not want to bring a cause of action against their consumer. They want to have that ability to work that out. This does nothing for that. It just forces people to get sued quicker. It affects their credit rating, and it is not good for consumers. And as Mr. Carey indicated, there is no rash of litigation in Minnesota. Our medical malpractice claims in Minnesota, 110 a year out of 5 million residents. The total volume of injury cases in Minnesota is down 40%. There are only 3,800 claims filed. We are not a haven for lawsuits. And the last point I'd like to make, two last points, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Thornsgill said that these claims may become stale. He didn't say that they didn't have merit. He didn't say that they weren't injuries that deserved compensation. He just said that they may be stale. These are valid claims. Very few of them come in year 5 and year 6. But when you have that situation where you've been injured and you need to avail yourself of a longer statute of limitations, we don't need to take away that right. And a couple points on other states. While it is true that some states may have a shorter statute of limitations, unlike Minnesota, they provide for a discovery rule. This bill does not do that. We have a long statute of limitations, and it's consistent with contract and personal injury, and we have that without a discovery rule. So the date of the injury is the start point, and you've got 6 years from that point. No discovery of your injury. And I also want you to know that the 4 years, as it relates to contract claims on lines 2.24, would become one of the shortest in the country. Alabama, Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Georgia, Hawaii, all 6 years. Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, 10 years. Kentucky, 15 years on contract claims. Louisiana, 10. Most states, I'm keep going, Mr. Chairman, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota at 6, Mississippi, 6, Montana, 8. There are over 35 states that have 6 years or longer for contract claims. That's not a business issue. I mean, that doesn't create jobs. What this does is just say that we are going to cut off exposure for legitimate claims by consumers and businesses, and we're simply going to say that after 4 years, whether you discover it or not, you're out. And we think that's unfair. It's unprecedented to take that away, and it has been the law since statehood. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We're happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, when you said the discovery thing, how many states do you say ours does not have discovery in any of those?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, this issue came up last night in the House Civil Law Committee, and I'd need to go and do a detailed analysis of every single state and what their discovery rule may or may not be in each. What I can tell you is that in states like North Dakota, they have shorter statute of limitations in some causes of action, and they provide for a discovery rule. I can't tell you that I've done a research project on every single state, whether or not they do or don't have a discovery rule. My point is, from the research that I have done, is that many of them do provide for a discovery rule and an outside limit. You know, if the bill even was fair to say a 2-year statute of limitations with a discovery rule, with a 6-year outside limit, even that would be better than just simply saying we're going to go to a flat running 4 years. So I can do that research, Senator Marty, but since that issue came up last night, I just haven't had the opportunity.
Because, Mr. Chairman, I guess I think the discovery thing is much more important than the length of the overall cap on the number of years. Because if somebody doesn't find out about something for 4 years, you're out of luck. And if, I mean, I think that there should be some way to have, if you discover something a couple of years down the road, that the clock starts ticking then. And shorter period is fine if you have that discovery, but when you just say that you're going to reduce it to 4 years, I guess I have a real problem with that. If you're not going to have a discovery set back the clock for that period of time.
Sir Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Murray, I'm not sure you were in the room when we had the testifier, Mr. Thorne's Joe here, talk about accrual and when does a lawsuit or the right to bring a lawsuit accrue. In most instances, it's when it's discovered that there's been a violation of rights. And I know that Mr. Carlson is really good at getting blood pressure up, but the truth is that there's no deprivation of rights here at all. The rights stay the same. Nothing about this bill would change anyone's rights. What it would do is ask folks that if they have a claim, that they file notice pleadings within 4 years of learning that they have a claim. That's pretty straightforward, and I think that's a matter of responsibility. If you have a claim and you want to file a lawsuit against someone, I think it's reasonable to say, especially in areas of contract law and indebtedness, that you bring that claim within 4 years. I don't think that that's depriving anyone of any rights. It's just asking them to be responsible when they realize they have a lawsuit.
Mr. Thornjoe.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, the other dynamic as to discovery is seen in Subdivision 1-6, which is the provision for relief on the grounds of fraud. There is a specific statutory discovery period of time upon which that would begin to accrue. Clearly, if someone is injured immediately, they understand that they are injured, they know that they can bring their claim, that's clearly the time when the cause of action starts. Fraud is inherently something that may be not above board. And so this is a perfect example of where the discovery rule is never impacted by the proposed change in the legislation, nor does any other applicable discovery rule change by this legislation as well. I am dealing with a lawsuit right now, which is a premise liability claim, where the alleged tortious actions occurred in the 1980s. It was brought at the point in time in which the injury was discovered, and therefore the time frame began at that point in time. So none of this change by changing from 6 to 4 years changes any of the established law in Minnesota regarding discovery and therefore commencement of the time in which the lawsuit begins. It only changes the time once they are aware of their injury and lawsuit of when they can bring it. And in this day and age of instantaneous advertising and instantaneous abilities to address issues, it merely reflects just the modern society.
Mr. Carlson.
I'll let Mr. Carey.
Or Mr. Carey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The provisions relating to fraud aren't a real change from the current law. If fraud is being committed, that extends statutes of limitations in all kinds of circumstances. The implication is here that injured people or others harmed are sitting around on their hands going, oh, well, I know I have a claim, but I know I live in Minnesota. So I'm going to sit on it for a while and file my lawsuit in year 5 instead of year 3. And that's not accurate. I've been a lawyer for 24 years. I've never seen that, where somebody came to me and said, well, I knew I had a claim 3 years ago, but I know I live in Minnesota. We've got a 6-year statute, so I'm going to sit around for a while. That's not what happens. People don't discover the injuries that they have always right away. There are all kinds of other reasons why a 5 or 6 year statute of limitations is appropriate. None of them have to do with the fact that people are sitting around on their hands and not pursuing legal remedy or rights that they honestly believe at the time that they have. Businesses do that all the time. Individuals do that all the time. I am unequivocal in my statement that I've never had anybody come to me in year five and say, yep, I knew I had a claim. I guess I better get going because I live in Minnesota. So those are my comments.
And Mr. Chairman, and members, just so that I'm clear, is it Mr. Thornjoe's opinion that Minnesota law provides for a discovery rule on injury claims that are covered by the change in this bill moving from 6 years down to four? And I also would like the committee to know that section one of the bill, which deals with the statute of limitations on unfair trade practices, unlawful trade practices, has no operative effect on section two of the bill. So the discovery provisions that he's talking about relative to unfair trade practices is not applicable to section two of the bill. But if it's his testimony today that we already recognize a discovery rule in Minnesota for personal injury cases, that'll be news to us. But I want to make sure that I understood Senator Ortman and Mr. Thornjoe's testimony correctly, because he said it starts when you discover your injury. That's what their testimony, I think, just was.
Senator Ortman or Mr. Thornjoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson is absolutely incorrect. What I said was that the law of discovery of causes of action in Minnesota are unchanged by the proposed change in this bill.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess to whoever could answer this question, I'm trying to figure out what kind of injury would take 6 years to figure out.
Senator Wardman.
Mr. Chair, that's not even the question. The question is, once you know you have an injury, you have 6 years to bring the lawsuit. We're saying, you know you have the injury, you should bring that lawsuit in 4 years. And the other testifier here has said that he's never seen somebody purposely sit on a lawsuit, but I have seen many lawsuits filed on the last day of the statutory period, many times. And so we should be moving that so people can get those lawsuits filed, so people can deal with them, and we can seek early resolution. There's an awful lot of delay built into a six-year statute of limitations, and it is expensive for the courts and all of the litigants, regardless of which side they're on.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ortman, good answer. And I do, it's so weird, you know, sometimes in committees when you have all this personal things you can have. But I did have.
Hit by a car, maybe?
Yes, hit by a car, those kind of injuries. But actually, I just had a lawsuit that we did win that was filed that took years in the court, and it was filed one day before the 6 years. It was on a septic inspection I did. And how can I remember 6 years ago what the conditions of soil were? What the condition of the development was, because things in the soils change over that six-year period. So you can go out there. We went out there after in this court case, and it was a lot that didn't have a lot of development around it. The development increased. There was stormwater ponds. All the water changes. And so when I see things like this, I guess I'm kind of appalled because every circumstance can change in that period of time. And so as a person that was subject to that one day before the 6 years, I think shortening it to 4 years, certainly this gentleman, if he thought he had a problem, knew about it a long time before that 6 years and waited till one day before that 6 year statute of limitations to file in court. I think that's egregious to the public. That's egregious to people like me.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Jungbauer. Like you think of a different example. Like you think about clergy abuse through shame, unwilling to admit it. I know the date that it happened, but I'm unwilling to talk about it. I'm not ready to move forward. I can't admit it to my family. You're saying that that person who has a very valid claim is unable to bring that claim through their own personal inability to express it is going to be terminated now at 4 years when the law from statehood has been six. And that is a very real example. I do a lot of work with battered women. And I can tell you that their ability to get over battering and be ready to confront someone through a legal situation is very difficult. And so while I sympathize with your improvement to real property problem, you need to think about, I'd like you to think about a larger group of people. And there's not any evidence, nothing has been presented here that said these claims are not valid, are not meritorious. They just happen to be filed at the end of the statute of limitations.
Mr. Carlson, the example of the abuse of a sexual victim, isn't that a different statute than what we're talking about today?
Mr. Chairman, I think right in the bill it talks about domestic abuse on line 2.23, 2.25, and it does apply to those other personal injury cases.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, trying to get everybody's blood pressure going here, but this does not apply to the clergy abuse case, because in that case, we do have a latent discovery rule, and the cause of action does not accrue until it's been discovered. And it doesn't even begin until, if it's a minor, it doesn't begin until that minor is 21, is my understanding, and counsel is here. Hopefully she can confirm that, but there is a discovery provision for clergy or sexual abuse of minors. So I hope we won't try and create a whole bunch of scenarios that are fear-mongering here. We're talking about breaches of contract. We're talking about indebtedness. We're talking about fraud. We're not talking about clergy abuse of minors.
Senator Jennifer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Carlson. Some days I think I'm already being here too long, because I understand in the time I've been here that we can't create a law that's going to fit everything perfectly, and that's why if a law affects somebody wrongly, we create an exemption, and I think the exemptions exist for anything that you're talking about here, but it seems rather ludicrous again to give people a longer period of time when they know they've been injured, when they know something's happened, because people do in fact wait till they know. People can't remember. There's a foggy memory, and that's an abuse of the system. So we can't make a perfect law. All we can try to do is come up with something that covers a lot of abuses within the system, I guess, or a lot of situations that we need to correct.
And Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Carlson.
I think dating back to Senator Latz's time in the House, they've worked on legislation to change the statute of limitations to provide for a discovery rule for sexual abuse cases. So, I mean, I don't know if the bill has been introduced this year or not, but I know Representative Simon has carried the bills on several occasions. There's a decision called Blachowiak that I know I've sat at this very table and talked about that addressed the statute of limitations in abuse cases, which do not provide for a discovery rule. And so, I mean, that's happy to fix that problem, because it is a serious problem. But this, I think this makes it worse.
Any further discussion? Senator Thornhill, or Mr. Thornhill. Sorry to demote you.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. It's the gray hair. Mr. Chairman, members, I would point you merely to Minnesota Statute 541.073, which is entitled Limitation of Time Commencing Actions for Damages Due to Sexual Abuse, Special Provisions. This is the special provision statute that applies to sexual abuse situations, which is not being impacted by today's bill, and the statute of limitations for that special legislation is 6 years.
Further discussion? Hearing none. Senator Ortman renews her motion. Oh, is there anyone else wishing to speak on behalf of, in favor of the bill or against the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing none, Senator Ortman renews her motion. At Senate File 373, be recommended to pass. Was this amended, Senator Ortman? I can't recall. No. Be recommended to pass and proceed to the floor. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Ortman. Senator Ortman, you want to stay there and keep moving?
I sure do, Mr. Chair. We have Senate File 530, and Senate File 530 is about how much the prejudgment interest should be for lawsuits in our courts. And what we're talking about there, members, is once a plaintiff wins, that plaintiff in the award is entitled to prejudgment interest that dates back prior to the actual lawsuit being filed. And we want our plaintiffs to have some interest that accrues on their damages. However, current law is set at 10%, which is too high in my view. And we have a special rule for governmental units as parties. They get a specialized rate of 4%. What we don't want to do, members, is incentivize members to park a lawsuit in a court because the rate of return is better there than it would be if that money were invested elsewhere in the economy. It's a disincentive to early resolution, and it's an incentive to leave a lawsuit languish so you can earn a very good rate of return on your investment. Again, Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Sylvester is here to testify in support of this bill.
Welcome back to the committee. Mr. Sylvester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I remain Court Sylvester, still a shareholder at the Nile and Johnson Lewis firm in Minneapolis. Senate File 530, which would return Minnesota to the pre-2009 approach to prejudgment interest, is of great interest to myself and my clients because the current statutory scheme is fundamentally unfair, and it's out of step with the purposes behind judgment interest in Minnesota. It's important to note that this bill is not about prompt payment after a judgment has been rendered. That's post-judgment interest, and it's not affected by this bill. This bill is about what happens to a lawsuit from the date of notice of claim. This is interest that accrues before the lawsuit is filed and then after the lawsuit is filed until judgment is entered. And the purpose of pre-judgment interest is supposed to be about encouraging resolution of claims in a prompt manner. But the truth is, any amount of pre-judgment interest that exceeds the normal market rate of return within our economy accomplishes that end. It accomplishes that purpose. Unfortunately, currently, we have a level of prejudgment interest which vastly exceeds that market rate of return, and therefore, it is unfairly punitive and arbitrary. Senate File 530 achieves the purposes of prejudgment interest, that of encouraging prompt resolution of disputes, while also balancing that interest against the interest in preventing plaintiffs from accomplishing a windfall by parking their lawsuit. So it pegs the interest at a market rate indicator and therefore provides a rational touchstone for the amount of prejudgment interest. The time between when a claim is noticed and when a judgment is rendered is largely out of the defendant's control. It depends upon many factors such as how long the claimant waits to proceed with the lawsuit, the court's docket, discovery proceedings in the case, and how long it takes to get to judgment. So it's not that, I mean, there's no way that a defendant can protect themselves against an extensively long-running period of time during which prejudgment interest racks up, unless that is for reasons other than the merits of the lawsuit, to simply concede and settle early. And we shouldn't be encouraging people to settle for reasons that are not connected to the merits of the claims against them. This is particularly a concern in Minnesota, given, as we just heard, the long statute of limitations that currently exists in Minnesota. And it's interesting, I was pleased to hear Mr. Carey remark that in the context of the statutes of limitations, we shouldn't be setting our policy based upon what other states do, because that was the primary justification for raising our prejudgment interest rate in 2009. The argument was that Minnesota's rate was substantially lower than most other states, and we should try to bring it back into balance with that. In truth, however, prejudgment interest, like any other interest of public policy in Minnesota, should be determined by what is right and what is fair. And what is right and what is fair in the area of prejudgment interest is what the market dictates. We are committed in this state to free market principles. And free market principles require some kind of economic touchstone to which we link the issue of the amount of prejudgment interest. So the only way that we can ensure that the current rate for prejudgment interest is in sync with the appropriate indicators is to have what this bill does, what Senate File 530 does, and that's return us to a rate that is tied to some indicator, in this case, the one-year Treasury bond rate. That achieves all of the purposes of prejudgment interest without creating a windfall. And it also includes the 4% floor. We can't drop below the 4% annual prejudgment interest rate. So it ensures that there will always be a meaningful rate of interest to achieve the policy goals of the statutory scheme, while at the same time balancing things against economic indicators. I can tell you how the 2009 amendment to the prejudgment interest rate is working out in practice. In practice, it is doing a great disservice to the businesses and small businesses, individuals in the state who are sued. I can tell you that the settlement demands that my clients are seeing since the 2009 statute went into effect contain huge components for prejudgment interest that weren't part of the discussion when we went to mediate these claims and attempt to settle them 3 or 4 years ago. This is particularly a problem, as I said, given the long statute of limitations. I can give you the example. Just Tuesday, I received a notice of claim against one of my clients. The accident happened in October of 2010. They have until October of 2016 to bring suit on a negligence claim based on that alleged injury. It could be another 4 or 5 years before a judgment is rendered. So there could be almost 10 years of prejudgment interest racking up at a rate which right now bears no rational relationship to any kind of economic forces or an indicator of what the value of money is over time in our economy. And SF 530 returns us to a situation where there is at least a rational market-based limitation on how high that interest can go, and therefore it puts this statutory scheme in balance in a situation when it's currently out of balance. So we would urge passage of Senate File 430. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvester. Any discussion? Is there anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Senator Carlson, welcome back.
Check your blood pressure. Just leave. Shh.
My loving spouse says she likes it when she can see the veins on my temples popping.
today she may like that view.
Today might be one of those days, Mr. Chairman. Joel Carlson here on behalf of the Association for Justice. And I've worked on the issue of post-judgment interest for a long time. In fact, I think even Senator Limmer carried a bill for me on this issue several years ago. But, Mr. Chair and members, post-judgment interest serves three very important functions. One is to compensate the injured party for the loss of use of their own money. Two is to promote prompt payment of a money judgment when it is rendered. And three is to prevent frivolous appeals of awards so that the defendant can do better by not paying and investing that money than if they were to just promptly pay the judgment. And Mr. Chair and members, Minnesota is in line, I don't want to say perfectly in line, but we are in line with most states on our rate of post-judgment interest. And the rate that was set at 10% was not just picked out of the air. You need to know that the business-friendly state of Texas, that we hear a lot about, has a post-judgment interest rate of 18% on contracts and between 5 and 15% on other judgments. Alabama, Kentucky, Massachusetts, North Dakota, Rhode Island, Vermont, Wisconsin, all at 7, or excuse me, those seven states have a 12% rate of interest. There are 13 states that we're aware of that have 10%. The lowest that we can find, which was Minnesota until 2009, is Virgin Islands, which has a rate of 4%, which is where this bill takes us back to. Mr. Chairman, we think that the rationale for setting a reasonable post-judgment interest rate and the reason the legislature made the change in two ways, one, to increase it to 10%, and two, to apply it only to money judgments that are in excess of $50,000, gets at the very problem that we were trying to address, which is frivolous appeals, which we know were happening, and to compensate people for the loss of use of their own money. We are not out of line with other states. This is certainly not a jobs or competitive issue. That our neighbor Wisconsin, right next door to us, and we have a lot of comparisons with other states, is 2% higher than what we're at right now. We just don't think that there has been any reason to return Minnesota to the lowest rate of post-judgment interest. And we do think, quite frankly, that a change in behavior on settling cases and moving them forward is probably a good one. And if that was the net effect of the change, and they are now settling cases quicker and paying them and compensating people for their injuries quicker, that's a good thing. And so, Mr. Chairman, we have concerns about going back and turning the clock back in this way, which would bring us back to the lowest rate of interest on judgments in the country.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson, I agree with you as to the reason why we should have the pre-judgment interest. You had indicated post-judgment interest, but I think you meant pre-judgment. And you're right. There is a reason for that, but the interest rate is not supposed to be punitive, and 10% interest in this day and age with our current markets bears no resemblance to reality, from as near as I could tell. So, while I agree with you is that there are reasons to have it, 10% is more punishment than anything. And I respectfully disagree, and I would indicate to the members I do support this bill.
And
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, the bill specifically deals with post-judgment interest, and your entitlement to pre-judgment interest is a different, can be controlled by this statute or a contract or whatever agreement the parties may have. So that is not actually prejudgment interest. Is only implicated when there isn't a stated rate of prejudgment interest in an agreement between the parties. So this bill deals with post-judgment interest and only serves to operate on prejudgment interest where there isn't already an agreement in place. So I don't. Unless I'm completely misreading this, Mr. Chairman, which I don't think I am, that's what it applies to, is post-judgment interest. Now, and Mr. Chair and members, for your constituents who are being deprived the use of their money and are having to buy things on credit card and delay payments, they are not paying 4% interest on the money that they have to borrow while they're waiting to be compensated when someone else has injured them. And so, while I agree that is a reasonable concern, you need to know that what most states do is set a flat rate. They do not have a formulaic equation as we have had in the past in Minnesota, and we currently do for judgments under $50,000. And it seems to work well, and that we believe that it was an appropriate change that was being made.
Sarah Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There seems to be some misunderstanding about prejudgment versus post-judgment. Parties can agree through contracts or other agreements to what would be a prejudgment interest amount. This bill and the statute sets the standard when they don't have a separate agreement. So it is prejudgment interest, and the public interest in a post-judgment interest, in my view, can be different than a pre-judgment interest. What we're talking about is the difference between when the claim is filed and all the way to the time of award, which would all be pre-judgment interest, and then you get to the point of judgment, and then there could be a very different order by the judge, the different order for post-judgment interest. And some of the things that we were talking about before about you don't want frivolous appeals and things like that, yes, they should be considered if you're talking about post-judgment interest. But the major concern we have here is about the pre-judgment interest and what rate that lawsuit maintains as an award of interest at the end of the lawsuit, and what could be, under current law, a 6-year statute of limitations, and then the pendency of the lawsuit. It could go for many, many years with that award of prejudgment interest at 10% plus an order of post-judgment interest after the verdict is rendered. Mr. Sylvester.
Just to clarify on the issue of whether the bill addresses prejudgment interest, subsection B, which is not being amended, specifies what the subsection C calculation formula applies to, and it provides to pre-verdict, pre-award, or pre-report interest on pecuniary damages being computed as provided in paragraph C. And then paragraph C is where the new language in the proposed bill comes forward, which changes the verdict calculation or the interest calculation from a flat rate of 10% to the one that is linked to the 1-year Treasury bill. And that is the policy issue that I was attempting to address with my remarks, was the prejudgment interest rate. The issue of whether there is a sufficient incentive for people to pay a judgment that has already been rendered is a legitimate one, but it's taken care of by the post-judgment interest, which is a different matter in which this bill does not change. And as to the achieving the policy goals of pre-judgment interest, that is adequately accomplished by any pre-judgment interest rate that exceeds the market, which is what this bill would provide.
Mr. Carlson.
And Mr. Chairman, unless it's provided by in contract or agreement by the parties, but the point is that we're not just changing a market rate on prejudgment interest. We're changing it both for prejudgment interest, if it's applied, and post-judgment. We're not leaving the rate at 10% for post-judgment interest as I read the bill. Right?
No.
Mr. Sylvester.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Now you just promoted him.
Promoted everybody here today.
I have to warn you now, Counselor.
I'm appropriately chastened, Mr. Chair. The calculation, which is being amended by Senate File 530, is the paragraph C calculation, and paragraph B only applies that calculation to pre-verdict, pre-award, or pre-report interest, except when there is a contract or agreement between the parties to use a different rate. So it's our reading of this bill that it does not affect post-judgment interest, only pre-judgment.
Mr. Chairman and members,
Mr. Carlson,
when I see the lines on 2.19 and 2.20 and 3.1 to 3.3 deleting the stated 10% rate, I'm having difficulty understanding how we're not deleting that on both pre- and post-judgment interest.
Is there further discussion? Senator Marty.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to know what it is. I hear them arguing over which way it is, and I don't have the rest of the law here, and I'm trying to figure it out. Is it both or just pre?
Mr. Chair, can we refer to Council?
Senator Artman, Council. I'm keeping up.
Mr. Chairman, members, I was starting to get confused there, too, so I pulled the whole statute up. And I think if you look at Subdivision 2 and 549.09, it says, during each calendar year, interest shall accrue on the unpaid balance of the judgment or award from the time that is entered or made until paid at the annual rate provided in Subdivision 1. So that's what, the language isn't in the bill, but that's what picks it up for the post-judgment.
In English,
so it applies to pre and post.
Mr. Marty, is that clear to you?
Could you translate in English first?
It applies to both.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Martin, it applies to pre-judgment and post-judgment.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Martin.
I think the same arguments would apply, that we should be talking about market rates for pre- and post-judgment interest. I wouldn't disagree that that would be a good change as well.
Senator Carlson, anything more?
Mr. Chairman, with the formula that is in the bill, just so you know, that brings Minnesota back to the lowest rate of post-judgment interest in the country, and not by a little, but by a lot. And the same claim in Wisconsin, to get that paid and to prevent a frivolous appeal, is calculated at 12%. And there are at least 13 states right at 10, just how we have it. So we think that is a step in the step backwards for Minnesotans and Minnesota consumers for what we don't see as any benefit at all. I mean, if the idea here is for the insurance carrier to retain their money on a judgment that is owed, so that they'll invest it in something that we don't know. I mean, we just went through a $700 billion taxpayer bailout of AIG, a $700 billion. I mean, what if that's what we're trying to do is allow them to keep their money and not pay it to people who have been injured by their insureds? I think that's just unfair.
Mr. Chair.
Sir.
So. I have concerns about the bailout, too, but I don't think that's really implicated here in my bill. I would say, however, that the prime lending rate right now is less than a quarter of 1%. And to have interest rates for pre- and post-judgment awards at over 10 does not make sense. And it doesn't matter how many states might have that wrong. I think we should get it right here in Minnesota. And I don't know how many have maybe made adjustments since what I would consider to be the Great Recession, but it does not make sense for us to incentivize folks to maintain lawsuits to earn extremely high rates of interest.
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I thought Mr. Sylvester, I wrote this note down, and I don't know whether you or your witness said, but public interest has a different interest in post-judgment than pre-judgment. And that's why I wanted to know whether it's post or pre or both. Because, I think the point that Mr. Sylvester or you or whoever made was to me the pre-judgment. There's a different interest in that than in the post-judgment, and that's why I guess I'd love to see, I was willing to support it for the pre-judgment, but not the post. And now you're saying, oh, we should get them both down. I was persuaded by the part about the pre-judgment, but post-judgment, I think that just gives them the incentive to hang on to the money. They should pay it right away once it's owed. And I think if you want to fix the bill to do that, it looks to me to be a fair thing for the pre-judgment.
Senator Ortman.
I appreciate the guidance of Senator Marty. And it was not my intention when we sat down here today to lower the post-judgment interest rate. That was not my intention. And I do think there are different public policy interests, and I would encourage Senator Marty to offer an amendment. I would support it to take out any change to post-judgment interest and maintain only the change in this bill to the pre-judgment interest. And we can take up the post-judgment interest another day if necessary, but my intention here today was with respect to the pre-judgment interest, and so I hope to earn Senator Marty's support here today, and I hope that we have, and I hope to continue to earn his support.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, I have no clue how to draft that because I don't know how to read it apparently the first time because I was waiting for Senate counsel.
And Senator Marty, it probably will take some time. Senator Marty, I'm being told that council would have to go through the effort of drafting, and it may take an extensive time. What I might suggest is you work with Senator Ortman as this bill progresses.
And Mr. Chairman, we have two other bills yet, or am I?
One other bill.
Senator. One other bill.
Or two other bills. That's right.
Maybe we wait and see if she can. Senate Council is very fast at drafting very complicated things, it seems to me.
Counsel, how long do you think it would take to do Senator Marty's amendment?
Mr. Chairman, maybe it involves pulling up a section of law that's not in the bill, so it would have to be generated. So I'm guessing like 20 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, I came down here after another committee adjourned after 2 or 3 hours after you started, and we were still on the first bill at that time. So let's see if she could draft it, if we could lay the bill over for a little while and work on the other bills.
Senator Hartman?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that. I'm wondering if to expedite matters, if we couldn't move to recommend that this bill be passed to the Senate floor with adoption of an amendment by Senator Marty. We could actually do that on the Senate floor. I give my word that we would do that on the Senate floor. I think that's where this bill is headed. If the members are concerned about that, we'll wait. We'll lay the bill over. But
Mr. Chair, let's see if she can draft it in the next few minutes. But
Mr. Chair, I would move to lay the bill on the table.
The bill is laid on the table. Senate File 1183, Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, can we maybe let Senator Newman present
Senator
Scheid's bill so I can just take a few minutes to regroup and
Senator Newman,
reorganize
my are you
file.
Ready? Thank you, Senator Ortman. Senate File 429 was originally Senator Scheid's bill, and Senator Newman was asked to present her bill on her behalf by Senator Scheid. Welcome to the committee. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, I have been requested by Senator Scheid to present Senate File 429, and I'm happy to do so. Just as a real brief synopsis, this bill deals with attorney's fees. And the general rule in Minnesota is that each side pays their own attorney's fees, and there are exceptions. One is if you provide otherwise by statute or if you provide by contract. And in this particular bill, Subdivision 1, directs judges to take into consideration certain criteria when statutory authority allows them to make an award of attorney's fees. Subdivision 2 deals with Rule 68, which is what's called commonly an offer of judgment. And I would ask you members to take this bill into consideration very seriously, especially insofar as Rule 68 offers of judgment are concerned. Rule 68 offers of judgment are a very significant and useful tool in resolving litigation because it forces the parties to address the possibility of cost disbursements, attorney's fees being added to their bill, and therefore really does drive a great deal of impetus in resolving lawsuits. I do have a testifier here that is ready to walk through the bill, which I'm going to ask him to do at this point. And then after that, Mr. Chairman, I am going to make an oral amendment to the bill of very, very short, and I will ask counsel to help me with that. At this point, if we could have the bill presented.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Marshall. I'm an attorney who practices in Minneapolis. I practice in the area primarily of employment litigation. I'm also the past president of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, which is an association of over 700 attorneys in Minnesota, which practice in the area of the defense of civil litigation.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present on this bill this afternoon. This bill does deal with Rule 68, and I'll start with the second half of the bill first. Rule 68 is a mechanism by which as stated, parties can evaluate their claims, and hopefully we'll evaluate them early on. And what the rule provides, and I'm going to talk about right now the federal rule, which Minnesota's rule was modeled on until a couple of years ago. Under the federal rule, a party assesses their claim and then can make an offer of judgment. And a defendant would make an offer of judgment saying, you can take judgment against me for X amount of dollars. And and just so you understand, this bill addresses fee-shifting cases where there's money amounts of damages involved. This isn't involving injunctions. This isn't involving equitable relief. This is involving situations where there's an award of money damages. In that situation, someone would make an offer of judgment saying, I allow you to take judgment against me for X amount of dollars. And let me just use an example. Let's say it's an employment case where I deal with frequently, which is fee shifting is involved. And let's say a person has lost their job for discrimination. They've obtained another job, but they're out of pocket, $10,000 in damages and wage loss, and they have mental anguish of $10,000, and they have attorney's fees early on of $5,000. Party could make an offer judgment for $25,000, saying, I'll let you win. And the party then has to assess, meaning the plaintiff assess, well, do I want to accept that or go forward? And, of course, under the rule, the former rule, it would say that, well, if you go forward and don't do any better, you would obtain an obligation to pay the defense's costs in that matter, in addition to your own. And those are costs like filing fees, expenses of litigation, such as deposition costs, that type of thing. And the federal courts also looked at that in employment cases, for example, and said, and in matters where the other side would obtain an award of attorney's fees, we're not going to let them get attorney's fees after the point in time they rejected your offer, which was reasonable. Because, you know, it's, and as the Supreme Court said in the Merrick case, a critical factor in assessing these awards and offer of judgments is the degree of success obtained. And we're not going to reward someone for refusing the opportunity to resolve their case reasonably before by getting less in a matter such as that. Now, what happened in Minnesota a couple years ago is that our Rule 68 changed. And our Rule 68 now provides for different types of offers, a damages-only offer, an obligation to, or a and what's called a total obligation offer, where a person can offer judgment against them for fees and costs, et cetera. But what our present offer of judgment rule added, and I can speak more on this in a minute, but they added a provision that if a party rejects a reasonable offer, the provision says that the attorney fees available shall not be affected. In other words, the party can continue. And this creates, obviously, an interesting issue. When you're defending a case that has fee shifting, which I do daily, what use is Rule 68? Very often our cases, the damages that plaintiffs have incurred is not substantial. And very often we assess these cases early on, and the vast majority of my clients are smaller businesses. They aren't insured for these claims. Some are, some aren't, but most of them are not. I'd say 60% of the work I do in litigation, no insurance is there. They don't want to face a case in court where they're looking at the responsibility of paying the other side's fees, and even if they win, even though the statute would say that a prevailing party may obtain their fees, they know in 99.9% of the time they aren't going to be able to do that, no matter how bad the claim is against them. But on the other hand, if they lose, they're going to pay 99.9% of the time of the other side's fees. These cases are very expensive. Now they have a rule that offers no assistance, but it also does something else that's very interesting. A plaintiff in a situation where they could get an offer of judgment has to weigh the risk of whether or not they want to go forward. Is this offer such that I could do better? And under the present rule, our existing rule, if they don't do better, they would have to pay the defense costs incurred after the time of the offer, not fees. Their fees are not affected. But their attorney's fees are, as the current rule says, not affected. It creates a conflict situation between a plaintiff's attorney and their lawyer. The lawyer has to now has the ability to say, or certainly has, and I guess an unintended incentive to continue with litigation because its fees or his or her fees are never going to be affected by refusing an offer that even makes their client whole. While the client, on the other hand, of course, could face a penalty if they don't do better because they'd have to pay the other side's costs. Now, this interesting conflict, I mean, it's unfortunate. It shouldn't exist. The incentive shouldn't be there for an attorney to decide, well, I'd just soon go forward with this case because I can run up more of a bill. Now, hopefully, most attorneys don't think that way. But unfortunately, an incentive has been created in our present Rule 68, which is not right, and it needs to be rectified. We have a rule that has no application for defense now. It's not used. And we have a rule that creates an unintended conflict between an attorney and their client. The proposed bill intends to rectify the situation by returning the Rule 68 issue with regard to money damages and offers of judgment situations to what was formerly the case, so everyone can weigh the risk of going forward. And this isn't an issue of cutting off attorneys' fees. The issue is who's going to pay them in the long run. And so a plaintiff attorney, along with their client, can weigh the risks of going forward. Are we going to go forward? Because if we do, and we don't do better than what they're offering us today, you have to make a choice. The choice is you might be responsible for their costs, and you'll have to pick up my tab for my attorney's fees from this point on if you don't do better. It only makes sense if the rule is going to have any teeth. The statute also addresses another issue in the sense of if an offer of judgment is made in an attorney fee situation, that the other side should disclose the amount of the attorney fees incurred when the offer is made. There will be certainly an argument said that, this only discloses our thoughts and what we've done on this. But the committee should understand that at the close of a case, when a plaintiff makes an application for their attorney's fees, all that information is disclosed to the court and the judge, allowing the other side to comment on that and make their opinions as to whether those fees were reasonable or not for the ultimate award. What's being asked for how much fees do you have incurred at the time of the offer, certainly is not unreasonable in any means. And how else is a court going to measure whether the offer made by the defense at the time of the offer of judgment is reasonable or not? The first half of the statute also looks at the issue of attorney's fees with regard to the amount of the award received. And again, we're looking at fees to a party that's recovered money damages. I'm expecting that you'll hear complaints about, well, how is that addressed as far as persons who seek injunctive relief or whatever? Well, the relief they receive is certainly different than money damages. And all the bill requests is that the court consider the amount of the award in damages in relation to the fees. And this is no different than what the United States Supreme Court said with regard to Rule 68 in the Merrick case, as I talked about earlier. You measure these things by the critical factor of the degree of success obtained. There's nothing unreasonable about that in the sense of when you have cases such as, I don't know if you're familiar with the Flowers versus City of Minneapolis case, where a person sued the City of Minneapolis and a couple of council members for defamation and a 1983 violation. They were awarded $1 in damages and $2 in punitive damages. This is a federal court case before Judge Montgomery. The plaintiff's attorney sought $55,000 of attorney's fees for this case. Ultimately, Judge Montgomery looked at the critical factors and said it just would not be right to award $55,000 for a $3 judgment and reduce the fees. Now, the attorney was paid $12,000 in that case, not a small sum, but the factor was taken into consideration. There are other cases such as where persons are awarded, the fees are more three, four times the award of what it's there. The court should take that into consideration. It doesn't mean that the court has to reduce the fees, but it's indicating where some courts now have indicated they don't feel they can. One last comment on the Rule 68 aspect about this. when the Rules Committee for the Supreme Court recommended this change, they felt they couldn't make changes of a statutory nature, and that's why they put this in there. And I corresponded. I'm on a task force appointed by the Supreme Court that's looking at areas to make our civil justice system more efficient, especially with budget issues and everything else. As part of that task force, I'm actually participating in a subcommittee with David Herr, who was on the Rules Committee for the Supreme Court at the time. And actually, I corresponded with him the other day on this issue because I thought this is another one which would help increase court efficiency by providing courts the opportunity to remove cases which can be settled between the parties, where now we have a rule that's gone unused now for the last 3 years. And in our correspondence, he understands the issue, certainly the issue of the conflict created between the plaintiff attorney and their client as well. But see, this is a statutory judgment, and this would require statutory changes for the situation. This isn't a rule change. These fee-shifting statutes are a creature of the legislature, of this body, and this is the body that can make the change to fix them. And for that, we believe this is a reasonable change. It promotes the settlement of disputes. It promotes judicial economy. It's fair to all parties and certainly deserves passage. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Newman.
At this point, I'd like to offer a short oral amendment. First, I'll offer it or outline it, and then I will explain what I have in mind. On line 1.1, after the word damages, insert sought compared to the amount. So I believe the line 1.11 would now read, compared to the damages sought, compared to the amount awarded. And what I have in mind, and I will tell you, committee members, I'm not married to this idea. I'm simply thinking that sometimes there is amounts that are pled that are relatively small as compared to amounts that are pled for an amount in excess of the sum of $50,000. And it simply gives one more item or another element of, or criteria for a judge to evaluate in taking into consideration the amount of attorney's fees awarded.
Any discussion? Senator Letts.
Well, no, not to the amendment.
Is there anyone who wishes to speak to the amendment?
Oh.
Ms. Pontius, would you have a different way of wording the Newman Amendment?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think you still want to retain sort of this concept of the relation between the amount of damages awarded and the attorney fees. So I would suggest perhaps just adding another clause on page 1, line 11, before the period insert, and the relation between the amount of damages sought and the amount of the damages awarded.
And Mr. Chair, I thought that's what I had done. I do have in mind to retain the idea of the relationship between the amount sought and the amount awarded. So, Ms. Pontius, any way that can be worded is fine with me.
Ms. Pontius, could you repeat your suggestion?
Mr. Chair, members, it would just be on page 111 before the period insert, and the relation between the amount of damages sought and the amount of the damages awarded. So they'd be considering both the relation between the amount of damages awarded, between the attorney fees in relation to the amount of awarded and the amount sought and the amount awarded. Sir, is that right?
Let me try mine once more and see if this makes sense. On line 1.1, it would read damages sought compared to the amount awarded. Does that not accomplish the same thing and is simpler language? I will defer, Ms. Pines.
Mr. Chairman, so then it would read reasonableness of the attorney fees sought in relation to the amount of the damages sought compared to the amount of damages awarded.
The way I am reading it is, if we go on line 110, it would be reasonableness of the attorney fee sought in relation to the amount of, now I see your problem.
Damage.
It's dawned on me.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Ms. Pontius, if you could give us your suggested language one more time, I'm going to go along.
Sir Newman, can I put a third cook in the stew here? Maybe not.
No, you may not, Mr. Chairman. Please do.
Your first set of language, when you went after the word on 111, and damages, sought. What if you took the word sought out?
So the
amendment would read, starting on 10, attorney fees sought in relation to the amount of damages, comma, compared to the amount awarded to the prevailing party. I'm getting shaking of heads, so let's go back to counsel.
I think I can try to help, Your Honor. Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think I understand the issue, and I think your version is there. It's a prevailing party, let's end there at line 111, all right? And then we have, and in relation between the amount of damages sought and the amount of damages awarded. I think that's what you said, Ms. Pontius.
And
or maybe not in, it'd be and the relation between the amount of damages sought and the amount of damages awarded.
That's what I said.
I think
that's what I said.
I think that accomplishes it.
I believe that's what the council said. So any other question or any other discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Newman, any further discussion? Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question for Mr. Marshall. In the offer of judgment discussion, you kept referring to reasonableness of the offer being factored in, but I don't see anything in Subdivision 2 that refers to that, and as I'm reading through the details of Rule 68, I don't see any reference in there either that the offer must have been reasonable. Am I missing something there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lass, when I'm using the word reasonableness, I'm using an offer that's an offer under Rule 68 has to be equal to or greater than what the person recovered. That's what I'm considering reasonable when I say reasonable. So if I go and make an offer of a dollar to someone who's got $50,000 in damages, that would not be a reasonable offer. And, of course, my client would end up paying the judgment that they get against them at the end. When I'm using the word reasonableness, I'm using in the terms of a reasonable offer is one that someone would accept that would make sense to them to do. There's nothing in the rule that says the use of the word reason, but reasonable, but the whole import of the rule is that when you make the offer, you're making an offer that's purporting to be what the person will be awarded at the end. Otherwise, what's the purpose of it? You're allowing a judgment to be entered into against you. So It encourages people to make a reasonable value of their case, and I'm talking reasonable from the person looking at the case. What's this case worth? Here's our scenario. Here's our decision. Okay, well, they have judgment against this. We think this is fair. That's why you make these offers. At least that's how it's supposed to work. And if the person doesn't do as well, who refuses it, well, then the offer would have been reasonable because they would have done better had they accepted the offer. That's where I'm coming up with the term reasonable.
Mr. Chairman? thank you. Mr. Marshall, where I'm having trouble connecting the dots here is that if you make an offer that you know is going to be refused, under subdivision 2, you would still be entitled to get all the attorney's time records or fee records from the beginning of the case up to that point. Under the language of Rule 1. Or Line 1.17, the party that rejects an offer must disclose the attorney fees it has incurred to the date of the service of the offer. So if I'm the plaintiff's lawyer and you make me an offer of $1 and I, of course, have to reject it, at the same time I must disclose to you all of the attorney fees I have incurred on behalf of my client up to that point, which would include disclosure of attorney-client privileged information, quite potentially, and attorney work product information, which might not be as significant after a case is resolved and there's a verdict and I'm making a petition for fees, but at this point in the litigation, it could be immensely damaging to the case. And likewise, I could make a demand for $1 million to the defense, which, of course, you would reject because it would be completely out of bounds. But then you would, when you rejected it, would have to send me all the details of your time records and fees. Am I reading that wrong, or seems to me that's what the bill requires?
Mr. Marshall?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm not going to say you're reading it incorrectly, but I can tell you what the intention is. The intention is to disclose the attorney's fees is the amount of the fees at that time of the offer. And even when parties petition for fees at the end of the case, they don't disclose every item of every bill. They put areas into what's going on. But what's intended by this, I mean, frankly, what's intended by this bill is to have people make earlier settlement efforts to resolve these cases. And for example, if you look at I think it's the Merrick case. I'm not sure if that one was, but at the time there was an offer in that case. I think the offer was $50,000-$60,000. The attorney fees incurred at the time of the offer were $32,000, and the court made the specific inquiry as to what those fees were at that time. I can understand that parties could abuse that in the manner you saw it, but I think in that situation, a court would have the discretion to look at that and say, no, we're not going to let you abuse it in that fashion. Your offer was not appropriate under the rule. If I'm making a dollar offer as a defendant, which certainly would not be appropriate, because that's not what this is intended to do, or if the plaintiff made a $1 million offer just to get my time records. I think that's something that a court would address, and certainly as a party litigating case, I would argue that that should not be produced.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Lentz.
Given Mr. Marshall's explanation, it sounds like what they're seeking, not that I agree with the concept at all, but if going forward, you're looking for the amount of the attorney's fees, but not any more information relating to the basis for the attorney's fees, and let's just say on line 1.17 that it's the amount of attorney fees that it has incurred as of the date of service of the offer. If that's the information you want. Otherwise, if you just say the attorney fees, I think it could be construed as everything that substantiates it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
If Senator Latz wishes to make that amendment, I would accept that as a friendly amendment. I think he has a point, and it would be my reading of this bill that we are only talking about the amount. I would be very, very surprised if a court would order the disclosure of an itemized statement, for instance, of attorney's fees, because within that statement there undoubtedly is going to be some privileged information. On the other hand, woe be unto the attorney who would plug in an inappropriate amount in terms of his offer. So I would accept that amendment as a friendly amendment, Senator Latz.
So, Senator Latz, would you like to repeat your amendment, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, on line 1.17, after the phrase "must disclose the," insert "amount of."
Does everyone understand the oral amendment of Senator Latz? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion or the amendment is adopted. Any further discussion of the bill? Gentlemen, Mr. Hickey.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Now that's out of the way. Mike Hickey, I came up at the table too early, I think. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, but today I'm here to speak on behalf of this bill for Minnesotans for lawsuit reform. Our coalition strongly supports this bill and urges you to pass it. As you heard earlier, Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform is a group of many businesses representing about 58,000 employers, including NFIB, the Minnesota Chamber, and other groups, and we strongly support this bill. Our biggest concern in this area, just to give you a brief overview on it from our perspective, is that, as you know, we have about 300 fee shifts. And 10 years from now, we're going to have 600, I don't know, but we have about 300. And you read the language, the various language says prevailing party may receive fees, shall receive fees, shall receive fees at the judge's discretion. You'll see a variety of language in there as I reviewed a lot of these. The problem is in employment law cases, which are a growing concern to many employers and some other ones, that affect employers, the fee shift pretty much shifts one way, and it's almost impossible for a prevailing business defendant to receive fees. And the big case that came down from the Supreme Court is quite long ago, Siegertson versus Isani County in 1986. But that essentially sets the defendant's only going to receive fees when the case was frivolous, unreasonable, or without foundation, or was brought in bad faith. And this is an extremely difficult standard for somebody to meet. It's what we think this bill does, and the reason we urge you to support it. It brings the pendulum back a little bit. It doesn't impose a strict they have to pay fees to us, but if they, as Mr. Marshall talked about, they reject a settlement offer, take it to court, incur about another 50% of cost for both parties and get less, the defendant at least would only have to pay fees up to the point of the offer. And we think it's very fair. It's an incentive to try to resolve these things, but it also just makes a little bit of an adjustment and swings the pendulum back a little bit. Some of these cases have had large allocations of fees and very little award. One case out of Ramsey County, there's 129 employment law case, had $129,000 in total award, $330,000 in fees the taxpayers had to pay. And at this point, when it becomes a 2-to-1, close to a 3-to-1, it's very concerning. And I hope people on this committee would be concerned about taxpayers, small businesses, nonprofits, individuals, whoever has to pay this. And so that's what, or I shouldn't say individuals, but the other ones I mentioned. And so that is our real concern, and that we think this bill is very incremental, and it's going to swing the pendulum back a little bit. It's going to hopefully also encourage some settlements. The first section of the bill just allows the judge or requires the judge to examine the reasonableness of the fees in relation to how the case turned out, and I think it's been improved with the amendment of Senator Newman. So anyways, we strongly urge you to support this bill. We want to thank Senator Newman for pinch hitting here today. Senator Scheid's authored this bill for several years and wish he could be here. And thanks for the time.
Anyone else to speak?
Yes. My name is Nicholas Slade. I'm a consumer rights attorney with Berry and Slade, and I specialize exclusively in the area of consumer law.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Slade.
Thank you, Chairman. I want to speak in opposition to this bill. And firstly, as to Section 1, dealing with the reasonable relationship of fees to damage awards, this very policy goes contrary to the very reason that consumer laws carry statutory attorney's fees. The idea is that very often the injuries, the actual damages that a particular consumer may have suffered are very small, and the only way to allow them to get redress for their actual injury and to try and prevent future future fraud, which is what I really specialize in, is to allow for attorney's fees to be awarded. Now, oftentimes, as I said, the damage may be only $50, $100 that the consumer has been defrauded of. There's no way they'll ever be able to get an attorney to represent them if their fees are, if the attorney's fees are limited in some direct relationship to the actual damages suffered. This has, by doing this, you're not looking at the difficulty of the case, and you're not looking at how hard the defendant may have resisted admitting that they have done something wrong and coming forward and restoring the consumer's, recovering for the consumer's injury. This is saying we're going to look at the damage. And so by not looking at how difficult the case is and how difficult the defendant made the case by defending the case and litigating, rather than just coming forward early on and saying, well, we'll pay off and we'll make the injury good, this gives the defendant an incentive to fight and fight and fight, which is often what they do when there's no, even because they know that they can drag it out and they have the economic means to drag it out, when oftentimes the consumer who has suffered an injury cannot afford the time and energy and to miss work, to come to court, to go through long depositions, to go through the process. They know that if they drag it out, the consumer is the one that is going to suffer. And so by saying that you have to have some reasonable relationship between the actual damages and the cost of litigating, you are effectively cutting out a lot of consumers. I would also note that one of the other problems with this is, while it's just bad for consumers overall, that it only talks about when attorney's fees are awardable by statute. It does not address the fact that the other way attorney's fees get awarded under Minnesota law is by contract. Now, in the area of consumer law, contracts are generally what are called adhesion contracts. Anytime you go and sign something, I actually got a new phone today. After I signed up, you get this long printout that says, these are all the rights that the company has in going after you. And buried in there, I didn't read it. I never do. Nobody ever does. But I happen to know that there is a provision saying that if they have to come after you as the consumer, they get their attorney's fees. Now, if what's good for the goose is good for the gander, where they have their right to come after you for attorney's fees under contract, it's the same sort of thing. Shouldn't that same rational relationship, which I, as I say, I disagree with, but if you're going to pass it, shouldn't it also apply to when attorney's fees are awardable by a contract, especially in a consumer contract, where the consumer has no ability to negotiate the initial contract? So, I think this is bad. The other thing I would say is that saying that the judge must do this, must look at this relationship, takes away that some of the discretion. And so I can't offer changes, but I would say that if you're going to pass this, those are two changes that should seriously be looked at, that it should apply to all times when attorney's fees can be awarded, either whether it's under statute or contract. I also, dealing with the offer of the Rule 68 changes, I think that the changes about the amount of attorney's fees is a good one. The other problem with that disclosure requirement is that it allows them to keep retailering their offer in a way that is really designed to drive a wedge between a client and the attorney. What it ends up doing is changing the case from being about the merits of the case to being about a discussion of what the attorney's fees are. And so the rules, the offer of judgment issues sub 2 are also in the area of consumer law, and you know they're generally talking about employment law, which I know nothing about. In the area of consumer law, these work against the consumer and making it harder for consumers to bring cases, harder for consumers to really seek redress for injuries that are done to them. And so I would ask that you not pass these bills. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, in respect to the abuses which the testifier has just outlined, I would suggest to the committee that an aggrieved party would always have the right to file a motion in limine and seek relief from the court and some protection. Insofar as the thoughts regarding consumer contracts, consumers, insofar as the contracts that this testifier just described, really are and are in a very uneven bargaining position. And certainly if he wanted to come forward with a potential bill, I would be more than happy to entertain it next year. Mr. Chairman, an additional testifier has come to the table, and I would ask that you entertain.
Before we go further, sir, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, in response, I mean, he says, well, you can bring a motion in limine, but that's goes right back to this point about that's the increase in time and energy that the attorney has to spend in fighting these. That's the kind of thing that we're trying to get away from. You know, you're trying to make these settle faster, but if you have to bring motion and limine to do things, that's more time and energy, more cost. But every time I do put in more time and energy, I'm running up against this thing that says, well, wait a second, if the injury is, you know, only $1,000 or so, or even less, I got to be careful about how much time and energy I put in because I might not get recovered. That's the problem with these kind of things. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to go with our new testifier. Sir, welcome to the committee.
Thank
you,
sir.
Would you identify yourself, please?
I'm David Stowman, S-T-O-W-M-A-N. I'm an attorney from Detroit Lakes. And I've come down here because I testified on a similar bill about 6 years ago. At that time, I came as president of the Minnesota State Bar Association. Yesterday, I learned of this hearing, and I said, this is so important, I have to make the 7 or 8 hour round-trip drive to come down here today. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Welcome to the committee.
I think perhaps there's well-intentioned motivation behind the bill, but I think maybe there's a bigger picture that's overlooked, and that is simply this, that you're affecting about 250 to 300 different types of cases. Mr. Marshall talked about affecting employment cases. And my response to that is if there's an issue that relates to employment cases, then we should carve that out, deal with the issues that relate to employment cases, and correct whatever problems there might be. But what you're dealing with, and I just went through kind of randomly, the types of cases that we're dealing with are a shifting of attorney's fees when there's criminal gang nuisance, actions for being coerced into prostitution, stolen motor fuel, actions by an involved person for violation for receiving stolen property law, unlawful use of protected genetic information, unlawful release of health information, action for willful and malicious distribution action for willful and malicious destruction of leased residential property, wrongfully executed mortgage satisfaction certificate, civil liability for issuing a worthless check. we're affecting many, many different types of cases, and there was a I copied off, if anybody's interested, the cases that are affected, and there's about 250 to 300 of them, and so you're taking a wide swath for what I perceive to be a problem that's relatively narrow, and I think it's an improper way to approach it. Having said that, addressing the language of the bill itself, looking at the first subdivision one, I would suggest a modification of language. It indicates that in addition to other factors, take into consideration the reasonableness of attorney's fees and so forth. Rather than just say in addition to other factors, I would recommend that we list out some of those other factors. I think it's commendable that you want to provide some kind of standard, and it's appropriate. But rather than just say in addition to other factors, list them out, and here's what I would suggest. One factor, the time and labor required, the novelty and difficulty of the question involved, and the skill requisite to perform the legal services properly. Two, the likelihood that the acceptance of the particular employment will preclude other employment by the lawyer. Three, the fee customarily charged in the locality for similar services. Four, the amount involved and the results obtained. Five, the time limitations imposed by the client and by circumstances. Six, the nature and length of the professional relationship with the client. Seven, the experience, reputation, and ability of the lawyer or lawyers performing the services. And eight, whether the fee is fixed or contingent. And I think it would be appropriate for legislation to set out standards by which attorneys' fees should be measured, but I'd just suggest that we list all of them that might be appropriate, and I think that those would be the ones that should be added. As far as the Rule 68, quite frankly, I think that should be stricken. The Rule 68 is a court rule. The courts have made rules that relate to civil litigation over periods of time, and when they have a change to their rules of civil litigation, they have hearings on it, and people can present testimony, papers, or document, whatever, and after thorough study, they make their court rules. Now, what you're doing by legislation is changing court rules. If the court were to come in here and say, we're going to change the laws that you as the Senate or the legislature make, you'd be up in arms, and rightfully so, because there's a separation of powers. Likewise, the legislature should not be changing the court rules, I believe, and I think that that's inappropriate. So first of all, if I can summarize, one, I think we're taking too broad a path or too broad a swat. We should take things like labor or whatever it might be, if there's a perceived problem there, to take it and study that and act on it. It shouldn't affect the 200 or 300 cases where the legislature has already made a judgment of public policy. I believe that if the court or if this body were to adopt the provisions, I think the language in Section 1 should be added that I proposed. And three, I think that the Section 2 should be stripped away from the bill. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Stoneman. Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, I think Mr. Slade and Mr. Stoneman did a great job of pointing out some of the problems with the bill. I've worked on this particular issue since, I think, 1999. And the last time we had it in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee was in the spring of 2005. And at that time, suggestions like Mr. Stoneman made about enumerating what those factors should be, which are what the law is right now, were discussed. But where we ended up without having a bill is they took the issue to the Minnesota Supreme Court, to their rules committee, to have them address Rule 68. And they did that. And they revised the rule in 2008. And I just want you to know that the contents of the bill, as requested through the rules committee of the Supreme Court, the contents of the bill in Section 2 were specifically discussed, debated, and rejected by the Supreme Court Rules Committee because it was just unfair. And I'd just like to read from the Advisory Committee comments that when they changed the rule, this rule does not affect a prevailing plaintiff's right to attorney's fees to which is entitled under law or contract. In this respect, the revised rule, like the former rule, does not incorporate the cutoff of attorney fees that occurs under the Federal Rule 68. So our court specifically addressed this issue, found it to be unfair because important rights would not be pursued and would not be litigated, and has rejected that. And I think Mr. Marshall even participated in that. Now, this is, again, another attempt to come back and do what the court and the participants in the court refused to do when they were last asked to do this, and that was adopted in 2008. I also think the way the bill is structured is inconsistent with Rule 68 because it doesn't make a distinction between a damage-only offer and a total obligation offer, which the rule requires. And I can't see in the language of the bill how that would be ascertained, and so you would still have this question about whether or not the offer included attorney's fees, does it include interest. The rule, we think, as rewritten by the Supreme Court Rules Committee and adopted in 2008, works well, and that this additional or newest attempt to undo the court rule is not based on the interests of the litigants and their ability to pursue their rights, which is why we adopted the fee shifting provision in the first place. And just think of this in a mechanics lien case, where a fee shift is allowed, and you can make an offer. You have to go to foreclose on your mechanics lien. I mean, that's one that happens frequently. And now to put this burden on to those litigants, we think is just unwise. And there are over 300 now statutory fee shifts in law, and this does paint with a broad brush. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Newman. Mr. Marshall.
If I may, Your Honor, Mr. Chairman,
again.
I would like to first say that when they talk about the 300 statutes, there are 300 statutes in Minnesota that deal with attorney's fees, and I can tell you Rule 68 isn't broken out between different theories, whether it's timber being taken away from someone's property to employment law issues to anything else. And I can tell you that the Supreme Court did make their change to Rule 68, I also should make sure the, at least the testimony record is here, because Mr. Carlson has twice referred to me as participating in that, and frankly, I was not on the committee that did the rules change, and just want to make sure that's clear since that's the second time it's been said. Also, the Rules Committee, at least according to the chair of the Rules Committee, as Mr. Herr told me on Tuesday night, didn't do it because it was of any unfairness. They viewed it as a change beyond the scope of a rules change. In other words, dealing with the attorney fee issue, and they see it as a statutory judgment expressed in an applicable fee shifting statute, and this would be something that would require a statutory change in the future, which is why we are here. With regard to the factors that have been identified, the factors that were listed to you come from the federal case of Hensley versus Eckerhart, which is also applied in employment cases in Minnesota. That was an employment civil rights case. The courts are well aware of those factors. And the problem we have is why the statute or the bill is written as it is because courts apply those factors routinely, but what they don't do is they don't look at the reasonableness of the attorney's fees with regard to the award, and that's why the bill reads as it is. It's common sense. Everyone knows these factors. And as Mr. Slade, stated, certainly a court can take into the factors. If a defendant is making them jump through every hoop and running up the plaintiff's fees just to wear them out or whatever defendants are accused of, frankly, I don't do that, but, you know, there I can understand why people would accuse defendants of doing that. Well, certainly that's a factor a court can take into consideration, whether or not his award was $1,000 or not. And I guess I don't practice in consumer law, but I'm assuming there's other relief looked at besides that. But on the other hand, if there's a claim for $1,000 and there's $1,000 of attorney's fees incurred and the defendant makes an offer of $2,000, why should they have to go on with the case? That's what this bill is meant to address. And it's not meant to help unreasonable defendants, but it's also not meant to help unreasonable plaintiffs either. It's meant to bring fairness, and that's ultimately what this does. I've seen plenty of cases, and I deal with it every day. For example, drug testing cases in Minnesota. Minnesota has a basically strict liability. If someone does a drug test on someone in Minnesota and they don't have a drug testing policy, it's strictly liable. When that happens, and if we're lucky enough to be in federal court, I will tell my client, make an offer of judgment, make this person whole, and let's put them back to work or whatever so we can get this over with. In Minnesota, well, we don't have that ability. Matter of fact, what I have is attorneys who want to take depositions in California or Atlanta, which has just happened to me the other day. Actually, we ended up flying the person in because it was cheaper to do that because they won't accept an offer. Under our rule 1.5A and the rules of professional conduct, an attorney has an obligation not to charge an unreasonable fee for services. What I see is cases, look, I don't want to settle this now because I can make a lot more later on. It's the conflict that this rule that we have now presents for plaintiffs and their attorneys, and that needs to be rectified. It's only fundamental fairness, and I'm not accusing Mr. Stoneman or Mr. Slade of anything like that. But unfortunately, there are people out there who do take those advantages, and that's what we want to address. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. No, Mr. Marshall, ultimately it's the client's decision whether or not to accept a settlement offer and whether or not to pursue a case. And I've had many clients who care more about getting an admission from the employer that they were wronged than they do about the amount of money that's at stake in the case. How do you value the judgment in favor of the plaintiff other than the economic loss they suffered by being out of work for 6 months or a year when they were wrongfully terminated? The psychological judgment validating that they were right and the employer was wrong. And how do you factor that into the reasonableness of the relationship between the damages awarded and the attorney's fees that the client says, attorney, I want to keep going on this case because I want vindication. And I want the employer to know that they were wrong, and either to admit it, which they'll never do in a settlement, or to have a jury or a judge conclude that they were wrong and find that way. How do you factor that in the bill that you have before us?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Marshall?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lotz. You know, I understand where you're coming because, you know, certainly before I'm with the firm I was at before, basically I did 50% plaintiff's work, 50% defense work. Matter of fact, I was the plaintiff's attorney in the largest award in the ADA in this circuit, which I think still exists today. It's a number of years ago or not, but my clients had to weigh those issues. Unfortunately, our system doesn't provide a mechanism for which we can get a defendant to say they're sorry. We can only provide a mechanism by which they can bring a lawsuit for money damages, and that's what we do. And so when you're defending a case, which I do routinely, I have to defend the case by the only relief that's available in the system, and that's money damages, and that's how it's evaluated. And while I understand completely why someone would want to have the employer, you know, put on their knees and say they're sorry and they'll never do it, the law doesn't allow them to do it either. They can only allow money damages. And if they want to go forward with that trial, that's fine. They can make that choice. But that's their choice. Their choice and what the current rule allows them to do. I'm going to make that choice, but I'm going to make them pay for it, even if they're being reasonable in what the eyes of the court says is reasonable, meaning they're offering to make me whole in that situation. Let's say that's being happened. Should the defendant really pay for that? Well, I guess that's a policy choice. If you want to run up costs, waste our court's time with people who just can't get past an issue because they want someone to say they're sorry, relief that the court can offer, well, I guess that's a policy choice to make, but we have to work within the system we have. And to be fair for all, we think this bill does it.
Mr. Chairman,
yep. Sir Letts.
The amount of the attorney's fees that a plaintiff's lawyer may incur are not just the attorney's decision. If the client decides they want to proceed with the case, the plaintiff's lawyer has an obligation to pursue that case, even if the amount at stake is only $30,000 and they end up putting in $60,000, $70,000, $100,000 worth of time. And in fact, they might, maybe they'll get a verdict at the end, or maybe they won't, in which case they get nothing. The attorneys get nothing, and the plaintiff gets nothing. Well, they've invested six figures worth of time. And so it's a risky proposition. And you know as well as anyone else that 95% of the cases settle, and typically plaintiff's employment cases are taken on a contingent fee, and the attorney's fee is taken out of the settlement amount. It's not necessarily added on top of the measure of damages.
Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lotz, I can tell you in those cases where a plaintiff even has had the case on a contingency fee basis, I know of one case, and I've been practicing for 27 years, and about 20 years of that has been in employment law on both sides. I know of one case where a court did not award fees on top of the contingency fee, or on top of the ultimate award. So,
when they went to
courts
hurt.
Commonly add, and the case actually was a case against Sears, and I know it well because it wasn't my case, but another person in my office was involved with it. But the situation you're talking about is that a person can make their choice, and if they make the choice to go forward, if they're offered, let's say, offered significant sums to resolve their case, and what I described earlier as a reasonable amount, say it makes them whole, makes it close to whole, whatever. If they're going to make that choice to go forward, that's fine. What they have to understand at that point is, if I don't do as good as what these people have offered me, I run a risk. And the risk is my attorney's fees under this fee-shifting statute will only be paid up to the time I've made this offer. If I'm going to pay my attorney, whether it's out of the recovery or out of what, and I don't do better, that's going to be my responsibility. At least everyone knows where that's coming from, and we know where the risks are. In the current rule, the plaintiff has no risk. He can easily refuse it because I don't have to accept that offer. My attorney's fees are covered no matter what, and no matter how reasonable the defendant is, I don't care. There's no risk to me, except I might have to pay some costs. I guess that's the fundamental unfairness we see in the current system.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Letts.
Mr. Marshall's version applies if you go to verdict and can get the statutory settlement fees, but if you settle, the fees typically come out of the, as a contingent fee, come out of the settlement amount. And the attorney's fees may be factored into the amount that the settlement is, but it's never going to make the plaintiff whole, or rarely going to make the plaintiff whole at that point. And you keep coming back again to reasonable offers of judgment. And again, there's nothing in the bill that says the offer of judgment has to be reasonable. So, but I will, every plaintiff's lawyer here will know, and probably every defense lawyer will know, that there are their clients often care as much about the principle that's involved as they do about the dollars. And every lawyer has had the discussion with their client at some point that says, you know, you may have to back off a bit on the principle because you can't get everything. The law doesn't always give you that result. And money's going to have to suffice. Or you tell your corporate client that, you know what, it may make more economic sense for you to do it this way than it is to fight on the principle. Believe me, plaintiff's lawyers have that conversation probably with every client at some point in the process. But that sense of vindication, the importance of sending the message to an employer that they believe has treated them terribly, when they firmly believe it, that is a very, very powerful motivator for plaintiffs. And I will tell you also, 90% of plaintiffs who think they are former employees think they've got a claim, lawyers won't take the case because they're hard to prove and they're very expensive and time-consuming to prevail on. I reject 9 out of 10 clients who call me for those very reasons. I'm only going to take a case that I think I got a good meritorious claim. Now, I may or may not end up being able to prove it. But these aren't frivolous claims that we're dealing with here.
Gentlemen, This is the type of conversation we get whenever we talk about attorney fees. And they just kind of swarm in here and have a robust conversation. But I think we've heard just about everything we possibly can stand about the issue. And I'd like to have some action on the bill one way or the other. Is there any absolutely needed conversation? Hearing none, Senator Newman. Senator Newman moves Senate File 429 as amended and be recommended to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes prevail. Senator Newman, thank you for your presentation. Senator
thank
Ort.
You, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Ort.
On our previous bill, the prejudgment interest rate reform, Senate File 530, could we take that one off the table? Because I believe Senator Marty has an amendment he'd like to offer, and I think it's a friendly amendment.
All right. Senator Marty, are you ready?
Mr. Chairman, the amendment's really smiling. Very friendly amendment. actually,
a smiley
was not,
face on it. Right?
We'll judge that.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, it's the A1 amendment, and how I can tell that this is setting it for post-judgment interest rates is because I was told that it does, but I can't see how to tell the difference. But in any case, this would be to set the current law for the post-judgment, and leave so the bill would only be changing it for pre-judgment interest. I'll move that amendment.
All right. Senator Marty moves the A1 amendment. Any further discussion? Senator Ortman, you suggested that this was a friendly amendment to your bill.
Mr. Terry's got just barely a big enough smiley face. Looks
right.
Pretty good.
All right. Any further discussion on the Marty amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Ortman.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I would move the bill to the Senate floor.
Senator Ortman moves Senate File 530 as amended to the floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. There is no further action before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Oh, I am sorry. I tried. Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1183 has a delete all amendment, and I would ask the committee to accommodate the author by adopting the A1 amendment.
Senator Ortman moves A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1183 was brought to me by a very esteemed member of my community, Karen Umphress, and her husband, because they had an experience with outdoor recreational events. And what this bill does, it puts together some limits of liability for nonprofit organizations engaged in managing outdoor recreational activities. And the A1 accomplishes that by establishing a new limit for those types of events for liability and also for punitive damages. And Ms. Umphress is here to testify in support of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
I'm Karen Umphress. I'm the government relations officer along with my husband of the American Motorcyclists, Amateur Riders Motorcyclists Association, which operates as District 23 of the American Motorcyclist Association. We are working as a coalition along with other recreational groups, including the snowmobilers, the any off-highway vehicle groups, rollerbladers, fishermen, bicyclists. This is a recreation bill. This isn't a motorized or non-motorized bill. Basically, when in 2007 the cap was raised for all liability, went from $1 million to $1.5 million, small nonprofit recreation groups are having a very difficult time affording the insurance. In effect, we cannot get $1.5 million worth of insurance. We have to get $2 million worth of insurance because insurance is sold in increments of $1 million. Most recreation groups, such as the American Motorcyclist Association, can get group rates for all of its members. So any of my district's events or clubs can get $1 million worth of insurance at a very discounted rate. The second million, however, is a much different animal. We're the only state where, for our non-competition motorcycle events, we have to get more than $1 million. So the AMA does not offer $2 million worth of insurance at discounted rates. We can only get $1 million. So we have to go with the prevailing rate, which is generally double the cost of the first million. And this is creating a hazard or difficulty for a lot of these small nonprofit organizations. As an example, in 2007, the year the rule went into place, our trail ride, which is a non-competition, family-oriented trail ride of about 100 people, with about 25 of them being kids, we lost $500 in that event, and it was mainly because of the additional cost of the insurance. So we are asking for this very small segment of recreationists who basically are out there helping trails, doing maintenance for the DNR for free, to not have to pay this amount. And as an example, I want to give you a group of called the Norsemen. It's a motorcycle group that was established over 50 years ago. They are having their 53rd consecutive event in Snake Creek Forest this year, and there's never been any claim for any of our motorcycle or permitted events. We also have Doug Franzen here. He represents Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association, and he's going to give some more technical information about the bill.
Mr. Chair,
welcome
members.
To the committee.
My name is Doug Franzen. I am an attorney lobbyist for the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association, and I promise I won't talk about attorney's fees. Mr. Chairman, members, what this bill has come about from a coalition of recreational users. What it does precisely is it restores the state and municipal tort liability limits to $1 million. As Ms. Umpress had very well said, the cost of the additional insurance is an undue and, I will argue, unnecessary burden on recreationalists. Most all of these groups are volunteer citizens. These are not commercial enterprises. And it does pose a hardship. Now, how it fits in is that I can speak to snowmobiling, but I think our experience is general for all recreationalists. The state and cities and townships have done a wonderful thing in terms of leveraging volunteer labor to create recreational opportunities through the state. So a lot of our programs, our snowmobile trails, we have over 25,000 miles in the state, are funded through grants and aids to local units of government. As a condition of this grant, we have to provide insurance, which names the local unit of government as an additional named insured. Because their tort limits went up, that insurance purchased for their benefit became more expensive. We had to buy more insurance. Mr. Chairman, members, we don't think that's appropriate, and I think I used the term undue burden, because the additional insurance required under the law is not justified by the exposure. In over 30 years of representing the snowmobilers, I have not found a judgment that would be affected. I can't think of a claim that would be affected by this change from $1.5 million to $1 million in these limited circumstances. The exposure, Mr. Chairman, simply is not there. I've had a chance to have various conversations with the folks from the Association for Justice, and I believe they will tell you the same thing. We don't have the claims. We don't have this exposure. In sum, because of this law, we have to buy insurance at a higher price for the benefit of local units of government that they don't really want, but the law requires it, where the exposure's not there. I want to say a couple things what this bill does not do. First of all, it in no ways limits the liability of the users. This does not limit our liability to $1.1 million from 1.5. This is strictly for the benefit of the state and for the local unit of government. And it comes into play that we buy the insurance for their benefit. That's the deal. And that's appropriate. It's part of the genius of the program. Their function is administrative, and the various user groups are the people who go out and make the trails and other recreational opportunities and events happen. So there is no limitation on our liability whatsoever under this legislation. Secondly, there's no artificial cap on liability. There may be some instances where a local unit of government or the state says, wait a minute, we believe that by the nature of this activity or the nature of this event, $1 million is not sufficient to cover the exposure. Hypothetically, let's say there is a hypothetical city of Maple Grove that decides to have a snowmobile event on a race where they go around the lake as the ice melts, and the winner of the event is the last one that goes in the water. Well, at that point, something like that may justify a higher level of insurance, and there is nothing in this bill that would preclude the state or local unit of government from requiring a higher level of insurance in their sound discretion. If they do so, this $1 million cap is waived under existing law. It's under the subdivision A of the same statute. So where the state or the local unit is an additional named insured, which they are, that's why we buy the insurance, the state or local municipality liability is raised to the level of the insurance. So if there's for some reason, a $10 million exposure, say a large event, and the user group, the recreationalists, buy $10 million insurance for the benefit, that becomes, by virtue of existing law in subdivision 8 of the same section, the municipal court tort cap. We believe this is strong public policy. It promotes the benefits of that these recreational groups bring to the state. It promotes the Minnesota quality of life. And at the end of the day, we think it's only fair. We should not be forced to artificially buy more insurance than is justified by the risk. And as I said before, for many purposes, we're not second-guessing the legislature's 2007 determination to raise the municipal cap. But in this particular instance, where you have these groups, the nonprofit recreationalists, operating under a permit or operating under the authority of government, the higher limit is inappropriate, and restoration of the prior limit is the appropriate course of action. I would stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion for the testifiers? Is there anyone else that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Oh, sorry, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to comment that this is a good bill, that I've been involved with numerous nonprofit groups that have, just because the legislature, it's a great example of the legislature coming up with artificial numbers that don't exist in real life in insurance policies, and so you do have to go to the next level, which, in fact, in my area, there's been a number of community events that no longer exist because of the cost of these insurance policies. And as our testifier said, also being involved with air shows and things where people think there's a higher level of potential risk, they require more insurance. And quite honestly, that's why you don't see the amount of air shows anymore, is because the risk and the insurance costs are too high. So this doesn't tell somebody that you can find a higher risk and not require things. But I've been involved both with this 1.2 and 1.5, and people can't find those kind of policies. They have to jump to an extremely higher policy, which in many cases is not the kind of money that a nonprofit organization can come up with in order to put on their event.
Any other questions, Senator or Mr. Carlson?
I'm house trained, Mr. Chairman. Me too. Mr. Chairman, members, Joel Carlson for the Association for Justice. I was thinking of changing my batting average and saying I support this bill and see if anyone would vote against it.
Might make me reconsider, yeah.
But Mr. Chair and members, we've worked with Mr. Franz and the trail groups to try and resolve this. Is essentially an insurance issue. It's not a claims issue. It's not a tort issue. This isn't a tort reform bill. It's an insurance bill. You need to know that the increases that the legislature has made periodically to the municipal and state damage caps are needed and necessary so that those caps stay in place. The court has said, well, we will allow you to cap your liability if they are not periodically updated and they deny someone any type of recovery. They wouldn't hesitate to find a low cap unconstitutional by violating our constitutional right to redress. We have some questions that we want to work with Mr. Franzen on to make certain that the language is right and accomplishes what it does, but we appreciate and understand what they're trying to address and are not in opposition to this, with the caveat that we do want to make sure it's codified and in the right place, and we can handle that at a later date. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sir Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, would like to be in support of this bill. Spent a lot of time working with youth, looking for facilities, and sometimes they were too expensive, yet they sit empty because you can't use them because you got to pay so much. Mr. Franzen and I grew up together at Roosevelt and worked the YMCA for many years together, and I think we need something like this. We need to change things. So I'm in support of this.
Sir Hall,
I admit to that, yes.
Sir Hall, you're saying you went to school with this man?
I know he looks a lot older, but yes.
Well, I wasn't going to say that, but it's important to have it on the record, I suppose.
I wouldn't give him the microphone back.
It's all fair here, Sir Hall, Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Senator Hall was smarter than me, better athlete than me, and more popular than I was. And he learned how to vote right.
Any other discussion? Anyone in the audience wishing to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none. Senator Ordman, move Senate file number
1183 to the floor.
1183 to the floor, as amended. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. There is no further business before the judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I shouldn't be called Senator Tortman after
you heard about that. The committee is adjourned.